Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, members of the All Souls College, the university community, and guests from near and far. You're welcome to today's lecture. Last week, we explored the various ways the work of Gazbi Asiri and a few of our contemporaries engaged with and responded to the socio-political rupture and transformation caused by the 1952 Gamal Abdel Nasser military coup that became a full-blown revolution with consequential impact on life in Egypt as well as on international relations during the early years of the Cold War. Today, I turn to South Africa during the 1950s and 60s, when Hendrik Verwoerd, as Prime Minister, Interior Minister, transformed South Africa into what a contemporary newspaper described as his native empire by a messianic promulgation of racist doctrines that earned him the reputation as the architect of apartheid until his assassination in 1966. My concern today is how the ideology and political infrastructure of apartheid, as conceived and propagated by Verwoerd, registered in the work of South African artists, but especially that of Dumile Fenny, whose distinctive artistic imagination and compelling work earned him the moniker Goya of the Townships. By examining the ways in which the work of white and black artists engaged with, accommodated, and sidestepped the political, ethical, and moral questions raised by the ardently racist policies Verwoerd and his circle of Afrikaners carried out, I am also interested in how the specific formal language and subject matter Dumile developed staged a particular mode of address that, I argue, distanced itself from what was then thought of as good black art and trends in white art, and emphatically rejected a notion of the good patriotic art advocated by Verwoerd. I dedicate my lecture today to two people who helped me hone my writing skills as an art critic, curator, and art historian. First is the poet, Ada Udechukwu, who I met while studying art at Nsukka. She not only lent me her typewriter and gave me my typing lessons for the first time, when I began writing art criticism for Nigerian newspapers, she read and commented on my essays before I turned them to the editors. Her spare and lyrical poetry serves as beacons I looked to while shifting from the studio to the scholarship. Similarly, the art historian James Meyer, formerly of Emory University, helped me transition fully into art history writing and provided me my first model of analytical rigor and lexical clarity. I'm still in their debt for helping me on my journey and career as a critic and art historian. And with that, I turn to today's lecture. On August 15, 1995, 1 year in office, Nelson Mandela, as president, made one of the most controversial trips of his presidency. he traveled to Orania, a small settlement of several hundred residents in the arid and remote northern Cape region, to meet Mrs. Betsy Fairfoot in her home. Mrs. Fairfoot was by far the most famous resident of the settlement that to some represented everything, the new South Africa that Mandela fought for in his life to abolish. Named for the Dutch-born English King Richard of Orange, Orania was founded by Mrs. Fairfoot's son-in-law, Dr. Karel Boshoff, in 1991, a year after Mandela's release from prison and the banning on the banning of the ANC, thus paving the way for dismantling of official apartheid. It was conceived that this Orania as a post-apartheid homeland for Afrikaners, also called Boers, an Afrikaans word for farmer, who had no interest in living in a multiracial nation. Thus, by the time Mandela visited the town, it had attracted significant national attention to its critics. It was, and I might add, still is, a pathetic and controversial redoubt for unrepentant racists and enemies of the new nation. To its founders, it represented the last stand for a fearful people whose life, ways, and heritage were threatened by a black majority led by Mandela, but also a living monument to the ideas of Mrs. Fairfoot's husband, the man most associated with the five-decade project of nationalizing white racism in South Africa. During the tightly choreographed visit, Mandela and Mrs. Fairfoot had tea with Kick Sisters, a plated, syrupy, fried confectionery considered so patently Africana that a monument dedicated to it stands in Orania as a proud marker of Dutch-derived food culture. And as the visit rounded up, the 94-year-old host declared to Mandela, "I identify myself with the wishes of my people for a Volkstaat, Dutch for people's state, which I believe could be developed in this part of the country." To which he responded, "I want a united South Africa where we can cease to think in terms of color," unquote. In this rather strange exchange, in which Mrs. Fairfoot spoke about her people's desire for their own state and Mandela countering with his vision of a post-racial nation, lies the awkwardness and furore around this visit. For here was Mandela breaking bread with the wife of arguably the most hated white political figure among black South Africans. Even so, it was not necessarily the tea event or the motivation behind the settlement that riled even some of Mandela's ANC closest supporters. It was the sight of Mandela and Boshoff visiting the so-called Monument Hill, where the president, smiling as he inspected the statue of Hendrik Fairfoot, the man who from the moment he came into government until his death in 1966, executed his racist Afrikaner agenda with messianic fervor and deservingly earned the reputation as the architect of apartheid. At a time when South Africans were hotly debating the fate of monuments of apartheid, with some suggesting that they be dynamited and others arguing that they be banished to Boer amusement parks, what message did Mandela send by going to Orania and not demand, in the language of South African students 2 decades later, that the foot must fall? In the prickly atmosphere of the visit, it was quite likely that his national audience, black or white, missed the delicately powerful meaning of Mandela's response to the statue when he turned to Mr. Boshoff and said, "Well, you made him very small." What did he mean by pointing to the sculptural diminution of apartheid's big man, who Mandela emphasized was the source, quote, "of a lot of anger and bitterness about the experiences of our people have had in the past. A past largely shaped by Fefoot." What did he mean? In any case, the high-toned controversy around Mandela's visit to Orania was not only fueled by the difficult and contentious realities of building the post-apartheid nation, as it was fed by potent collective memories among black South Africans of a man they knew as the face, heart, and power behind their industrial-scale traumatization, oppression, and disenfranchisement, and whose apartheid edifice outlived him by several more decades. In pointing to that 1995 visit and to the existence of Orania, which has since grown into a thriving settlement, I signal the power of Fefoot's presence in the South African imaginary 30 years after his assassination in 1966. By the way, the blood-stained carpet the site of his assassination remained in the House of Congress until the 2000s. I thus begin my inquiry today first by examining how he earned, that is Fefoot, the reputation as a deserving member of the Club of the African Big Men, and second, how South African artists, including Dumile Fenny, responded to the apartheid state built by Hendrik Fefoot from the early 1950s to the mid-1960s. In 1937, Hendrik Fefoot was appointed inaugural editor of the Transvala, a newspaper established with the explicit mandate of growing the National Party and advancing the cause of a resurging Afrikaner nationalism in its original homeland, the Transvaal. Having established some reputation as a professor of psychology at the University of Stellenbosch and for his social work among poor white communities, Fefoot secured the editorship after participating in a high-profile protest against Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. Exploiting anti-British grievance, slowly simmering since the Anglo-Boer War of the first decades of the 20th century, led by the Afrikaner Brother Bond secret organization, Fefoot built his political capital as a champion of poor rural Afrikaners whose condition, he argued, could not improve without systematic racial segregation executed by a powerful technocratic state. The elections of 1948, in which only the white populations had franchise, brought a coalition led by Daniel Malan's National Party to power, giving the Dutch-descended Afrikaners the political platform for the first time to turn their once fringe racial supremacist ideology into a national project. With the triumph of the Boers in 1948, no small thanks to the newspaper Verfoed founded, in addition to his white social welfare campaign, the triumph of Afrikaner nationalism as state ideology was stamped on a hill overlooking Pretoria, one of the national capitals, with the inauguration in 1949 of the Voortrekker Monument, dedicated to the pioneers who trekked to the Transvaal between 1836 and 1852, where they founded the Boer Republics of Transvaal and the Orange Free State, a symbol so laden with meaning and a structure described by the British art historian Annie Coombs as, quote, some misplaced Bakelite radio. In 1950, hard right members of the National Party pressed on the Prime Minister to appoint Verfoed, known for his uncompromising nationalism, as Minister of Native Affairs. In that position, Verfoed set about transforming the then inchoate ideas of separateness of races for the benefit of the Boers into an operational system of government based on strictly enforced population management. In his first year, he created four racial categories with Population Registration Act, reorganized urban and rural space according to races with the Group Areas Act, and he criminalized interracial sex, which he blamed for the degeneration of white folk with the Immorality Amendment Act. 3 years later, he established an internal passport system for non-white people to regulate their movement and enacted the Bantu Education Act, designed to limit black education to basic academic instruction, thus making it impossible for them to qualify for political office or administrative positions in state and private businesses. This Education Act would have direct negative impact on the status and agency of black artists in Verfoed's South Africa. His Native Affairs ministry was so effective in formalizing apartheid that, as one scholar noted, quote, it increasingly adopted the character of a state within a state as it developed universal competencies for the administration of the African population, unquote. Thus, by the time he became prime minister in 1958, Verfoed was already a dominant force in South African politics. In the peculiarly racist democracy, Verfoed's own personal mission to build an apartheid state with the help of the Brother Bond made him a de facto big man, an autocratic leader of an African nation captured by a white minority group. Indeed, with the Sharpeville massacre of March 1960, of children protesting the Bantu Education Act, and his withdrawal of South Africa in 1961 from the Commonwealth to preempt international sanctions, Verfoed demonstrated his willingness to deploy extreme violence to achieve his personal political vision. As the scholar Dubois has noted about the early 1960s, Verfoed enjoyed supreme political power in what he called the era of Verfoedian high apartheid. Even as Prime Minister of a supposedly modern democratic state, Fairfoot presented himself and was perceived as the sovereign big man. For instance, in his dealings with the chiefs of the controversial homelands, well, in the years they call reservations, he created for black black South Africans, he often referred to himself as the Great Induna, that is, the Great Chief. And on goodwill tours through the homelands, he often brought gifts of cattle to dispense to the chiefs and enjoy being regaled by native dances and ceremony. True to the self-indulging big man, by arrogating the title which in the past African sovereigns sometimes bestowed on Europeans like the British adventurer such as David Livingstone and Nathaniel Isaacs, Fairfoot clearly meant to claim the authority sanctioned by indigenous African traditions in order to dominate, vanquish, and expel the same black nations and societies from his white South Africa. For presenting himself as the Great Induna, that is, the guardian of the black people, the historian Christoph Marx tells us that the white opposition leaders took to teasing him by calling him the White Shaka, in reference to the imperious 19th century Zulu king. With what has been described as his forceful inflexibility in the remarkably ruthless implementation of his apartheid policy, for which he earned the nickname the Man of Granite, Fairfoot all but achieved his goal of transforming South Africa into what the newspaper Cape Times called Fairfoot's native empire. In my first lecture, while noting the asynchronous histories of post-colonial modernism, I noted that in South Africa, the oppressive conditions of apartheid ensured that black artists did not participate in debates and discourses about modernism in Africa. Let me now state that the absence was a direct consequence of Fairfoot's use of education as an ideological tool. For the Bantu Education Act was designed to severely limit black access to higher education. And I should add that he must have learned something from the early 20th century education program of the British Indirect Rule, which prescribed only the teaching of technical subjects, concerned that arts and humanities education tended to produce troublesome educated natives. In apartheid South Africa, Bantu Education Act banned young, talented black artists from the art schools. And without that, they could not, like their counterparts in West Africa, take the driving seat in shaping the discourse around modern and contemporary art in their own country. Thus, the only option open to black artists were informal workshops and art centers run by liberal white artists and teachers. Moreover, the opportunities to represent South Africa in international exhibitions such as Venice and Sao Paulo biennials during this period were available only to white artists who themselves were either struggling to connect with their North Atlantic cousins by developing their own interpretations of European and American post-war stylistic trends, or contending with the contradictions of their white Africanity. This is how the art historian Anitra Nettleton describes the foot era art industry. And I quote, "All official South African publications were in Afrikaans or English, and those concerned with culture such as Lantern and South African Panorama covered almost exclusively the arts of the white community. The ideology through which power of all kinds were vested in white hands within the apartheid state denied Africans any history, denigrated their ability to make art as primitive, and referred to their aesthetic expression as Bantu art," unquote. In other words, Fefoot's Bantu Education Act had the direct effect of banishing black artists from the spaces of critical discourse or intellectual debate. And not only did the Group Areas Act and the Natives Resettlement Act of 1954 remove black populations to the so-called Bantustans, they also segregated black artists into the pedagogic homelands of peripatetic, semi-formal art centers and to a categorical no man's land they called township art. I'll return to this a bit later, but for the moment, let me paint a broad picture of white elite art and artists in Fefoot's era, as it will frame and inform our understanding of the work of Dumile Ferni and his circle of black artists of the same period. Recent scholarship has pointed to a major tension in the white South African art world during the 1950s and 60s, defined largely as a struggle on the one hand between the figurative impulse and legacies of supposedly conservative artists such as the Afrikaner nationalist painter J.H. Pierniff, known for his uninhabited romantic landscapes that conveyed ideas one might call Afrikaner manifest destiny, and the fantastic primitivist compositions of Alexis Preller. On the other hand, were the abstract confections of younger artists such as Eric Lobsher and Eduardo Villa, who were keenly attuned to the styles redolent of European post-Cubism and American abstract expressionism. Yet, it is impossible to not see the widespread avoidance of political subject matter and social commentary that is some expression of awareness of, not to mention engagement with, the radical transformations of the South African demographic, cultural, and political space by Fefoot's many official acts that by 1952 led to the massive nationwide defiance campaign against past laws, or the 1955 rally at Cliptown, Soweto, during which the ANC-led South African Congress Alliance released the Freedom Charter that laid down the democratic principles of future South Africa, which led, in the wake of mass arrests of the organizers, to the treason trials of 1958 to 61, the banning of the ANC, and the imprisonment of their several leaders, many of them white men and women. I should mention that the lead counsel for the defense in that infamous trial was the Exeter College alumnus, Sidney Kentridge, whose son, William, in the 1980s, emerged as a key figure in the anti-apartheid resistance movement. And that's Mr. Kentridge right there. The point here is that by driving his racist apartheid laws as Minister of Native Affairs and Prime Minister, Fefood gave political and legal support for government-sponsored exhibitions and publications and patronage for the exclusive benefit of the country's elite white artists who, in their work, apparently ignored the unjust system that funded their privileges. Put differently, what I might have called the Cultural Group Areas Act had the effect of denying black artists the possibility of competing for and laying at least equal claims to the contemporary art industry, as did their post-colonial modernist counterparts elsewhere on the continent, where they actively shaped the art worlds of their independent nations. But what is the politics that informed the struggle between figuration and abstraction among white artists in Fefood's high apartheid era? The scholar Federico Fresci has offered an insight with which I agree. In a chapter on Africana nationalism and changing canons of high art, published in the important four-volume Visual Century, South African Art in Context, he notes that despite the triumph of figurative and non-objective abstraction in the West since the Parisian avant-garde of the early 20th century, this mode of image making failed to take hold in South Africa's elite art circles until the full entrenchment of Africana political nationalism during the 1950s and 60s. He shows that the shift from illustrative work by artists like Pierre-Neef needed to create Africana national mythologies and revisionist histories from the 1930s to figure-dependent abstraction of Walter Batis and others in the 1950s, and finally the dominance of semantic abstraction by the mid-1960s. But he also argues that the political impetus for this shift had everything to do with the fact that the apartheid government promoted illustrative work first to consolidate Africana nationalism, and once firmly in power, could afford to, quote, shift to a celebration of the nation's objective modernity, unquote. In other words, it is misleading to read, as some have, the turn to narrative from narrative naturalism to non-objective abstraction in the mid-1960s in officially sponsored art and artists as signaling the rise of supposedly liberal artists critical of the toxic nationalism of the apartheid government. Rather, the rise of abstraction signified, in fact, the arrival of high apartheid, a moment when the Fefood government secured supreme political power, assured of the future of Africana nationalist project, and thus open to any manner of art, so long as they had no implied communist sympathies. One way to think about this scenario is to juxtapose it to the contemporary politics of the Cold War art and culture patronage that saw the CIA acting on behalf of the US and NATO powers, funding even radical work by artists and writers in decolonizing Africa and even South Africa, with the simple objective of keeping them busy to avoid the temptation of siding with communism and the Soviet bloc. In other words, Fefood's triumphant apartheid regime and its cultural agencies seem to not mind the rise of abstraction to the extent that it provided white artists the excuse not to meddle with the politics of what it called terrorists and communists of the ANC and other anti-apartheid groups. Does the picture I paint here about the white artists' response to Fefuti's apartheid mean that none of them deploy their work to comment on the regime's violent suppression of the black population? Or that the authorities ignored what it perceived as unabashedly critical art? Not necessarily. In 1962 exhibition at Gallery 101 in Johannesburg, perhaps inadvertently tested the limits of the regime's accommodative posture when the show was shut down by the authorities for including two works by Harold Rubin, who was Jewish, and Ronald Harrison, who was classified as colored. Rubin showed a naked, crudely drawn black Jesus, screaming with an erection as he hangs on the cross. For this offensive work, Rubin was arrested and charged by the Board of Censors under the anti-blasphemy law. Acquitted a year later, he left the country, settling in Israel. Harrison's case was a bit more serious. His painting depicted what was supposed to be the canonical crucifixion scene. But his Christ was not simply black. He had the face of Fefuti's arch enemy, the ANC leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Chief Albert Luthuli. And standing beside the Christ are his crucifiers, Fefuti and his right-hand man, Justice Minister John Vorster. For this painting, Harrison was detained and serially tortured, sustaining lifelong injuries. When he received a US scholarship, the authorities in South Africa threatened his family, forcing him to remain in the country, and like Doria Shafiq, if you remember, in Nessus, Egypt, refrained from presenting his work in public for years. Not only that, the painting itself was smuggled to London, where for a time it was displayed at St. Paul's Cathedral and circulated in Britain among anti-apartheid networks. Two conclusions we might draw from Rubin and Harrison's experience in the hands of Fefuti's censors are, one, that the anodyne themes and abstract formalism of the era's leading white artists, including Eben van der Merwe and Bessie Cilliers Barnard, were motivated as much by a desire for expression of artistic freedom and bond with their European cousins as it was about finding in such work a refuge from the terrors of a regime the man of granite leader had declared in his 1962 Republic anniversary speech that the determination to survive as a white nation had become absolute. The second conclusion is that for all its unapologetic domination of national politics and all internal opposition, Fefuti's South Africa remained paranoid and wary of its real or imagined enemies and demonstrated the willingness, as in Sharpeville and with the imprisonments of Harrison and Rubin, the capacity to suppress such art that it perceived as undermining its white supremacist ideology. Much as Fefuti desired through his apartheid laws and acts to separate white and non-white South Africans. And much as he was at the vanguard of Afrikaners who ridiculed those among them that argued the necessity of black labor in the maintenance of a successful white nation and its economy, the reality of a minority white population compelled reliance on cheap non-white labor and ensured the uncomfortable proximity of races. Though a few black artists emerged in the pre-apartheid years, the most promising among them, like Ernest Mancoba, Gerard Sekoto and Ernest Mancoba, with no clear path to good education or independently successful career at home, went into lifelong exile in Europe. But what about the black artists like Dumile of the apartheid generation? I had noted earlier the immediate impact of the Bantu Education Act, which made it virtually impossible for black artists to attend formal art schools inside South Africa, and that their only options for any art instruction were government-funded or private semi-formal art centers, usually run by white teachers. The most influential of these was Polly Street Art Center in Johannesburg, established in 1949 as part of a recreational center for the city's overworked black labor. It flourished between 1952 and 1957 under the directorship of the modernist printmaker and painter, Cecil Scotness, producing arguably the first cohort of modern black artists such as Sidney Kumalo, Ephraim Ngatane, and Ezram Lehi. At the helm of Polly Street, Scotness and his circle of white and ardently modernist artist friends and art dealers played a determinative role in shaping the aesthetics and the politics of black art in this period. Moreover, in 1961, Scotness joined his friends Cecily Sash, Eduardo Villa, Giuseppe Cattaneo, and Kumalo to found the Amadlozi Group, which advocated for a South African modernism supposedly founded on the art of the country's African ancestors, the Amadlozi. Never mind that, like the much admired Parisian avant-garde, they set their eyes on the formal qualities of West African and Central African sculpture rather than on the more geopolitically appropriate Nguni sculptural traditions of Southern Africa. Apart from the specious enterprise of white artists reclaiming their supposedly African identity at a time when being African, as Anitra Nettleton has argued, was a contested terrain, Scotness and the influential gallerist Egon Gunther encouraged their black words to look to modernist formal abstractions based on both European traditions and African forms. In other words, just as leading white artists found comfort and refuge in abstraction, Scotness and his friends used their privileged position to implant what they imagined to be an authentic Bantu modernism stripped of political content. This inchoate native modernism, a paradoxical mix of abstract and illustrative work, was promoted by the white art industry as township art, as if to bind it to the impoverished, segregated black townships invented by Fefoot and his Afrikaner nationalists. It is in this murky context of white artists' avoidance of political commentary, either out of fear of censors or because of their dependence on state patronage, that I see the imposition of Bantu Education Act to limit Black access to higher education and the knowledge power associated with it, and the encouragement of non-political work at Polly Street and elsewhere as having the desired impact on the work of Black artists of the period. It is not surprising, I believe, that it is in their drawing, that is, these Black artists, that they found the tool and voice with which to respond to apartheid's extreme politics. And this is what brings me to Dumile Feni, who in a few years developed a mode of drawing with incomparable formal complexity and ambition and thematic density. Moreover, unlike many of the leading Black artists of the 60s, he was not a product of Polly Street or the Jubilee and Mofolo art centers that succeeded it. And yet it is in his work, I argue, that we see one of the first consistent yet powerfully coded response to the politics and psychological subjection of Black South Africans under high apartheid. Born in 1942 in Worcester in the Western Cape, Dumile moved to Johannesburg as a teenager and for a while worked in a sculpture foundry. His first documented encounter with art making was in 1963, when he received art materials while hospitalized with tuberculosis. This early work clearly shows a young artist with rudimentary technical facility with picture making. But after meeting Sidney Kumalo and Ezrom Lekhai, he developed a sculptural language similar to their Polly Street modernism. But he also made friends with Bill Ainsley, a young white artist and activist whose Johannesburg studio was open to artists of all racial backgrounds and whose work, often depicting Black subjects with unusual sensitivity, must have impressed Dumile. In any case, it is through his drawing that in 1966, the same year Vefoot was assassinated, that Dumile erupted into the national scene with a traveling exhibition of works that was much discussed in the print media. Critics in English and Afrikaans media declared him a new star, but invariably identified him by his Xhosa ethnicity or as a Bantu artist, as if to emphasize, in the context of apartheid, the separateness of his identity. And despite gaining substantial patronage, especially among the non-Afrikaner networks, and his anxiety about the impact of life outside South Africa might have on his work, he went into exile in 1968 and died in New York in 1992 on the eve of his planned return home. During that four-year period of intense productivity, Dumile made interpretatively difficult work, whether it contains single or multiple figures engaged in mundane activity or involved in esoteric action, or depicts important contemporary events. And I argue that he adopted allegorical coded speech to allow the space of critical reflection on the condition of Black life caused by state racism. Consider, for instance, his massive train accident of 1966 that seems to depict the derailment near the city of Durban in 1965 of an overcrowded train carrying Black laborers, leading to the death of about 150 people and the retaliatory killing of the white signalman by an irate black crowd. Yet Dumile does not so much show us dead bodies as present the accident's victims in frozen theatrical gestures of terror and anger. Or is he suggesting that even the black dead are still in solidarity with the living in their expression of outrage over the impoverished and precarious existence under apartheid? Most of his drawings from this period are rendered in frenetic or pen and ink marks, his figures distorted as if to convey diseased conditions and states of existential hardship. Yet the difficulty of the resulting drawings lies not so much in the fact that they are not pleasant to look at as in their thematic opacity. Consider, for instance, filling a hole that supposedly show a quotidian moment in black life in the townships. In it, a couple set in a barren landscape appears to pour stones into a deep, irregular crevice. But are they mending the broken and damaged earth, laying the foundations for a new township shack, or burying a secret? Similarly, The Classroom, a work of remarkably compositional complexity, features what we must believe to be a classroom scene. At the top right, a woman, perhaps a teacher, reads a book to two naked children who pay her no attention. Below them is a chaotic scene of twisted, despondent, frightened figures, and further down, upturned clusters of double-headed women clutching an emaciated child, and a man forcibly lifting a woman's dress. Is this Dumile's meditation on the value of Fefut's Bantu education designed to deprive black people resources for self-enlightenment and upliftment from the infernal conditions to which white supremacist ideology condemned them? Here, as elsewhere, there is a powerful, ineluctable thematic opacity that suggests his preference for what I might call oracular expression and reluctance or even a lack of desire for direct visual speech. And this brings me finally to arguably Dumile's greatest work, the mural-sized African Guernica of 1966. No one, as far as I know, has given a definitive account of the subject of this drawing. However, many scholars reading the work through Picasso's Guernica have seen it as a damning statement on the oppressive conditions under which apartheid subjected black people. But I'm not so sure about this. And it is not just because it was produced at the time of, or more likely soon after, Fefut's assassination, the news of which, according to his close friend Omar Badsha, they celebrated with crowds at Badsha's neighborhood in Durban till the police dispersed them. Moreover, in this Guernica, there are no clear suggestions of violence or scenes of subjection. Rather, we have a layered montage of two naked men wheeling clubs, one riding a bull, the other with three legs perhaps falling off, a child suckling the teat of an inattentive cow, a formally dressed man seated at table pointing to a saxophonist in the shadows, a woman in mini dress attending to a diner, and a couple in amorous embrace, not to mention the dogs and goat quietly feeding in the foreground, and many more scenes that you can identify. Why did Dumile make this supposedly protest work right after the assassination of the invincible apartheid architect by a non-white communist anarchist who claimed insanity to escape capital punishment? Are the manic gesticulations of the three-legged figure and his bull-riding partner and the disturbing child-cow intimacy indicative only of apartheid's disorientation and dehumanization of black life? If so, what do we make of the inclusive scenes of rural and urban black culture and sociality? Whatever the meaning of this and other of Dumile's work from this period, here's what I'm certain about. The fervid mark making, the deformed and animated figures enclosed in darkness, and the desolate scenes contradict one of the oft-repeated arguments Verfoot made for apartheid. That is, that it ensured an Africana-led republic in which white and black and colored lived separately, yet prosperous and happy. More than any artist of his time, Dumile deployed the figural style and dark allegorical subject matter against Verfoot's greatest desire, expressed in one of his last public speeches before his assassination, and that was for a beautiful patriotic art that extolled the success and glory of his racist ideology, an apartheid republic. Maybe the censors didn't understand Dumile's parables. Thank you.